Now we come to a little more complex statement. I am showing you all this because these chapters 9, 10, 11, 12 are great examples of the presentation of data which are known, and presentation of that which is not known, and they are presented in such a way that the conclusion seems to be necessarily true. Or most probably true. Because the structure of the argument is of this nature, when you read these chapters, you will find how rigorously the entire statement is made, so that when you read them, at the end, your mind must be able to say, that is it, necessarily true. Or there can be no other conclusion than this. So that intellectually, in your mind, no doubt remains. So this is the condition. If there is no space, can you can come here. No? But to be able to understand this whole process, I have to introduce a further complexity. First, about the data. As I said, there can be no philosophy if there are no data. There must be some data before a philosophical study can begin. Secondly, we must strive to give as many data as possible, whatever is available. The larger the data that you have in your command, the greater will be the authenticity and certainty of your conclusions in regard to the data which are still not known. Now, what are the data that Sri Aurobindo presents in these four chapters? Evidently, there are data which are available in physics, chemistry, biology, psychology. But more than that, Sri Aurobindo also brings in the data which are available to human consciousness when it practices yoga, and bring those data also into the picture. But because the present mankind does not easily admit these data of yoga, Sri Aurobindo, while admitting those data and presenting those data, shows his cognizance of the problem for the present humanity. And therefore in the argument there are three aspects. While he admits the data from yoga, he shows that the present data without the yogic experiences are such and such. There are some other data which are available from yoga, and you may have hesitation in accepting them, but he shows why you should not have hesitation. There is an argument such that you are able to bridge yourself from the data which are available and which humanity accesses more easily to the data which are available but not easily acceptable to the modern humanity. This is the first task of the whole structure of his argument. Secondly, he shows that if you do not accept this data from yoga, then it will be impossible for you to arrive at any certain conclusion. And if you so prefer, you remain in the realm of uncertainty. But if you admit this data, then your conclusions will be certain. And both the possibilities are clearly mentioned. And thirdly, in deriving the conclusions, there is a strict rigor in which conclusions are shown to be necessarily implied, or most probably implied. You will notice when you read these four chapters, you will find actually this is true of the whole book. But in these four chapters particularly, you will find this illustrated most conspicuously. I did not speak of all this while dealing with the chapter on triple transformation and the ascent of the Superman because those two chapters particularly are related to the statement of yogic data. There the data available in the modern science are not so relevant. But here they are very relevant. Therefore the data available from modern science and the data available from yoga are both presented, but presented in a particular neat form, so woven together that every strand of the argument is clear and the alternative conclusions are clear, and when all the data which are presented, then the conclusions derived seem to be necessarily true or most probably true. In doing this, the law of identity, the law of contradiction, the law of extreme middle you will see are rigorously followed. Now, many people believe that logic consists of nothing but these three laws, study of these three laws. But all logicians do not agree with that view. For a long time in the history of thought, there was a view that logic consists only of the study of these three laws, law of identity, law of contradiction, the law of extreme and middle, which are actually one law. Looked at it from three different points of view. But there was a great logician and a great mathematician and a great metaphysician in modern times called Leibniz. He challenged the view that there are only three laws of logic. He introduced a fourth law in logic. What is that fourth law? He called it the law of sufficient reason. Now let us again go to back to our example to understand this fourth law. When Tushar was a very young boy, he asked his mother a question. Why is it raining? And she said something of the kind. She said, it rains sometimes. So he said, but why must it rain? And why must it rain sometimes? And why not all the time? This is the question. So she said, look, before rain comes, there must be clouds in the sky. When there are clouds, it rains. And Tushar was for some time practicing. You know, logic is also supposed to be a science which tells you by what reasoning human mind can be satisfied. What is that kind of reasoning which, when given, satisfies the human mind? The human mind says, all right, now I'm satisfied. So here you answered Tushar saying, when there is cloud, it rains. Then he went out of the room and saw a cloud. It was not raining. So he came back and said, there is cloud, it is not raining. So his mother was obliged to say that it is not that whenever there is a cloud, there must necessarily rain. Now you see here in the reasoning, in previous examples, when it was gold, it must not necessarily be black. It was black, it was not necessarily gold. But now you are asking, you are saying that when there is a cloud, it does not necessarily follow that it must rain. The first answer was all right. Why does it rain? Because there is cloud. But when there is cloud, now here was an example, it was not raining. So Tushar has an upper point now, and he says that there is cloud, it's not raining. So you are answering that it is not a necessary law that whenever there is cloud, it must rain. Then here's a further question. Why is it that does not necessarily follow? If rain is always dependent upon the cloud, then why is it that when there is a cloud, it does not necessarily follow that there must be the rain? For rain, cloud is a necessity. But for the cloud, rain is not necessary. Based upon this fact, Leibniz said that the world is not a world merely of necessity. If this world were ruled only by law of identity, only by the law of contradiction, only by the law of excess middle, then relationship of necessity would be reciprocal. But he says it is not so. The consequence depends upon antecedents. But antecedent does not necessarily imply a consequence. Therefore, he says this world does not operate only on the law of necessity. There are certain things which are necessary. But everything in the world is not necessary.